Veterans Committee on Emergency Preparedness come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
I read this and I liked it, and so I want to share it with you. And the title is Remember. It is the soldier, not the reporter, who has given us freedom of the press. It is the soldier, not the poet, who has given us freedom of speech. It is the soldier, not the organizer, who gave us the freedom to demonstrate. It is the soldier who salutes the flag, who serves beneath the flag, and whose coffin is draped by the flag, who allows the protester to burn the flag. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Madam Chancellor. Colleagues, members of the audience, and those of you on all us watching, we're going to not go down our work schedule or our agenda as published. We're actually going to open up a work session first and introduce a couple of committee members measures. Then we're going to open up a work session on SB 143 only to take input from ODVA into the status of their work on that one. And then we're going to go back to the top of the list on public hearings and go down the public hearings list. So with that, I'm going to open a work session for introduction of committee measures. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3893, dated 2-08-17. LC 3901, dated 01-27-17. LC 3903, dated January 27, 2017. LC 3909, dated February 6, 2017. And LC 4209, dated February 21st, 17.
Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanders has moved the legislative concepts as recited be introduced as committee bills. Colleagues, all of these are placeholder bills. Members of the audience, if you open one of these bills up and you see something, please don't get your blood pressure medicine over the top. These are all placeholder bills with relating clauses to emergency preparedness, veterans, military department, so on and so forth. And then the last 14209 is an SCR, which is designed to be able to put in veterans issues in terms of individuals that will need road signs and those sorts of approvals from the legislature through the end of the session. Is there any discussion on any of these legislative concepts? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. With that, we're going to close the work session on introduction of measures and open a work session temporarily on SB 143. Mr. Director, if you'd be kind enough to come up, colleagues, would you very briefly remind us what 143 is, and then we're going to receive an update on the status of 143 from the good director of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Council. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 143 requires the Department of Veterans Affairs to administer two grant programs to support existing and establish new veterans resource centers and coordinators on college campuses. The committee will recall this was previously heard on February the 7th. It has a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And we submitted written testimony that gives a landscape overview of what it looks like across the seven primary university system campuses and the 17 community colleges. So across, and what we did was both on those that have actual coordinators, student veteran coordinators, and then also whether they had a veteran center for their student veterans. Across the community colleges, we had three with full-time veteran coordinators with PCC, Clackamas Community College, and Chemeketa. Several of the other community colleges do have lounges, but not a full-time coordinator. On the university system, the three primary with full-time student veteran coordinators, Western Oregon University, Portland State University, and OSU, with the U of O, Southern, and Eastern Oregon University, all with a part-time coordinator. The only university that didn't have a veteran coordinator or student veteran center was OIT. We also included the landscape of the approximate number of veterans. So we had pulled that are going to each university system, as well as the community colleges, ranging on the universities from the most. And we pulled those that are going to school on the GI Bill, so kind of student veterans that are certified, is the definitive number, but then also an approximate number of veterans going back to school not using GI Bill resources. So most have more than are actually using GI Bill resources. OSU being the most, followed closely behind by PSU at over 1,000 student veterans, on down to Eastern that has only 120 estimated student veterans. On the community colleges side, for veteran landscape, about 1,400 veterans approximated for Portland Community College, on down to Central Oregon Community Colleges has the next at 642, and then on down to some pretty small numbers for Blue Mountain at 48, Tillamook Bay, 14 student veterans, Columbia Gorge, 4. So the total number across the community colleges, over 4,300, and across the universities, I don't know that I have the total on that one. I apologize. But happy to take any questions.
Ma'am. So those with coordinators, can you look to see if those with coordinators actually have more veterans? Can you tell?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, generally those with larger shares of student veterans have already begun shifting in this direction, and often a question of whether it's every campus or whether it's a full-time position, whether it's a student work study, and then the real mix, every university that is accepting GI Bill resources does have a certifying official as part of their financial aid office, and what we find, kind of the testimony that we had heard both here and in the House side, a difference between that wraparound support that a student veteran coordinator was bringing by just the certification of the classes from a financial aid and GI Bill resource. So some of these coordinators are also dual-hatted as those certifying officials and not quite as affected of the wraparound services. We did go over to the House side with a similar testimony. The bill was not over there, it stayed over here, but had the same testimony that went over quite well. And I think a question mark that I think is out there, we had initially envisioned this bill and read this bill as a grant program to expand and enhance but not be the full funding for these positions on campuses. And there's a question of grant programs aren't a great way to fund positions long-term because you live and die by that grant. If you plussed up a coordinator position on campus and then didn't receive that the next year, that would fall back onto your own campus finances. So it's how do you use these grant dollars to expand and enhance is one model. Off of the fiscal that the universities initially put in, a much more of an operational model that was funding positions. And if that's the case, you do want to try to ensure that that's on an ongoing basis so that rug doesn't get pulled out.
Oh. And Director, have you looked at it to see what is a good model in terms of like a package? If you were doing a push package, what it would look like?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I think where we still need to do a little more work is how much would we look to expand those that don't have it and how much would we want to enhance those that already have it. It's almost similar to the urban and rural on the camp or on the county VSO network. That's where we could still use some more guidance and also some discussion across the partners.
Questions, Senator? Council, if you would, we're going to roll this forward 2 weeks, and then if you'll set up a meeting between the two chairs and the dear director here, and we can kind of, sooner or not later, see if we can come up with some direction or some conceptual ideas so that we get some sort of guidance from our House members before we send this down to Ways and Means. And we can always flush a program out later, but I want to make sure at least that all the thinking is the same way and we have some support from the House before we send this to Ways and Means. Okay. You game, Director?
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you. With that, we're going to close the work session on SB 143 and open a public hearing on SB 129. Council, if you would, please, and Mitch, and I know there's someone from, Mitch Sparks is here from ODVA, and
Singer.
Nate Singer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 129 creates a task force on post-traumatic stress disorder to study and recommend improvements in diagnosis and treatment of veterans in particular and identifying funding sources. This measure, the committee will recall, was previously heard on the 14th. It has a subsequent referral to the Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability, and at the previous meeting, Mr. Chair, the bill sponsor, Senator Wright, testified, and you asked me to reach out to DHS, ODVA, Medical Board, Psychiatrists Association, Psychologists Association, and the Health Authority, and DHS and ODVA have both kindly come with some remarks. There's also a dash one amendment replacing the emergency clause with an effective date, the 91st day after sine die, and that is a step that Senator Riley has taken on all of his measures.
Okay. Mitch Sparks and Nate Singer, if you come up, please. And I'll preface this. We're not infatuated with task forces, as the good Senator Riley knows, but one of the challenges that we faced, and I do appreciate, Nate, you coming, and the reason being is that the problem the legislature has is when you're a budgeteer, it's amazing when you ask four agencies to come see you, they always come see you. But when you're a policy committee, you don't always get them to come. Now, I appreciate, and please send my regards to the director, that, you know, your agency has stepped up to ask questions, so on and so forth. Our challenge is how do you get the other agencies to do so without a task force and encumbering money? So I'm going to let ODVA start first, then we'll go to you, Nate.
Okay. Chair Boquist and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Sparks. I'm an employee of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Throughout the state of Oregon, with our county and state and national service officers, our VSOs have a priority with PTSD, veterans that suffer from PTSD. We're sometimes the first place of veterans ever talked about having PTSD or any of the symptomologies or issues that they're having is at the veteran service offices throughout the state. We also provide a very important link to both the claims and assisting the veteran into to finding out where the nearest treatment facilities are and provide that link and sometimes warm handoff to the federal VA to ensure that they're being treated for their mental health conditions. Current numbers nationwide, 797,000 veterans are service-connected disabled for PTSD. That constitutes 20% of the 4,100,000 that have service-connected disabilities in the country. A breakdown throughout the eras of war, World War II, 11,000 veterans, Korean, 12,000, Vietnam era, 380,000, and current conflict stretching back to 1991, 381,000 veterans are service-connected for PTSD. That's the third most prevalent service-connected disability with the federal VA. Disability ratings can go from 10% minimum to 100%. And when we file a claim for PTSD, they fall under three subcategories: PTSD due to combat, PTSD due to MST, and non-combat related PTSD. Prior to the 1980s change to the Title 38 law that allowed service connection for PTSD many years after their combat or active duty service, it was virtually impossible for veterans to get service connected for this disability. With that change, allowed the veteran to apply for service-connected disability and be service-connected for it. Claims today are taking 6 to 18 months with the federal VA. There are three elements to any successful PTSD claim: validation of a stressor, a current diagnosis, and last is a CMP. The CMP, the Compensation and Pension Examiner for the VA, must agree with the diagnosis of whether it be combat-related or MST-related. Most veterans work through the federal VA healthcare system for their treatment. VA has multiple options for their mental health treatment. That includes traditional mental health counseling at VA hospitals and their community clinics. They also have community-based counseling, which are called vet centers. There's five here in Oregon. And the VA also offers specialty MST care at the Portland VA Hospital for MST-related mental health treatment for veterans who suffer from that. The federal VA also has two inpatient treatment centers in the Pacific Northwest. One is at American Lake in Tacoma, Washington, and the other one is at the Roseburg VA Medical Center.
That's a specialty, Mr. Chair. You said it was a specialty?
No, I was just saying that they have a VA has inpatient treatment okay. also available.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. For VSOs, our goal would be for every veteran who has PTSD or any mental health related conditions that they engage in services early. Is that when a veteran engages early, it prevents a lot of the issues that we see with veterans. And they're very wide-ranging, but we know most of them, PTSD, suicide, substance abuse, through self-medication, domestic violence, justice-involved veterans, is that the earlier that they engage in services, the better outcomes that we see from our point of view. When we talked about MST-related PTSD, is that just one last fact, and then I'll be complete, is that 23 out of 100 female veterans reported a sexual assault while in the military. So just like the demographic of women veterans themselves is rising, is that we're also seeing a rise in MST-PTSD-related claims, too. So this is an area that we train a lot in and keep very apprised of any changes within the VA claims process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and be happy to answer any questions.
Chair, please.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I have to think of which title I'm actually here under. I am the Deputy Operations Director for Aging and People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. Today, I want to provide an update around the services and coordination we do with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs and the work we're doing around veterans within the Department of Human Services. For Aging and People with Disabilities, that has a large overlap with our veteran service officers in the community. We only actually have, that we know of, 2,277 veterans that we can identify within that population. We serve almost 600,000 individuals in that organization. We have limited capabilities to capture information around veterans in our computer systems that we currently utilize. So we capture them through basic elements around their income or benefits they're receiving that we do store. Of those, the majority are on long-term care services. Over two-thirds of them are on long-term care services, while a small portion just receive other benefits. However, we're doing some things to improve and really look at our outreach to veterans. Again, we continue to hand out veterans materials in our local offices across DHS. Those are Self-Sufficiency, Child Welfare, Aging People Disabilities Office, and through our AAA contractors, our Area Agency on Aging. We hand out a little over 800 of the outreach materials a month to individuals, providing information about how to be in contact with county veteran service officers. Some of the major work that we are doing is we're currently in the middle of a project, integrated eligibility project, that will allow us to come in compliance with House Bill 2422 from the 2013 legislative session. In that House bill, it instructed DHS at the point that we received a new computer system to implement the ability to ask veterans whether or not they, or individuals, if they were a veteran or their spouse were a veteran, and then to get a release of information to provide that with ODVA. We've implemented that in one of our online applications, and we'll be reaching out to ODVA to make that data available to them as a way to help additional individuals be in contact with veterans and their veteran service officers. As well, we're working on something called the Public Assistance Reporting Information System, PARIS. Not the country, if anyone thinks at any point that we're visiting there. Veterans Outreach. This is a report that DHS currently works. It's a three-part report. It provides information around retired federal retirees. It provides information about interstate match, and it provides information about veterans. We send over a file of every individual in Oregon that accesses our human services benefits. So if they receive Medicaid, if they receive long-term care, if they receive food stamps, temporary assistance for needy families, there's an intergovernmental agreement at the federal agencies. We provide this list to them on a quarterly basis, and they send back matches of individuals that may be eligible for a veteran benefit. We've now enacted an agreement with ODVA around that and are starting to provide them with information through this as another ability to have outreach to individuals that are veterans and hopefully connect them with the right benefits that they can utilize. Overall, as we look at what information we have within the agencies as we've continued to do outreach for veterans, Oregon has just over 72,000 veterans that are receiving a disability. Many of these individuals have interactions with our offices, and that's an area that we're looking to improve upon to be able to make sure that as we interact with individuals that have disabilities or any veteran, that we can make sure we connect them with their appropriate benefits. That's the testimony I came here today with. If you have questions, I'll be glad to receive those. Thank you.
I thought that there were already things going on with PTSD and with all due respect, that this is what I really wanted to know, that I mean, PTSD is so well known in the military and is really being handled, unless you feel there needs to be more work done, but I'm not sure what a task force, how that could help with what you are already doing. I don't know if you need to comment because you can't take a stand.
Well, I'll make some comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Vice Chair. I'd like both of you to comment. I mean, my intent was to, and I appreciate both of you gentlemen coming, but our intent is, as the good counsel of the committee pointed out, is we reached out to the agencies that are supposed to be handling this and have it. And we have ODVA, who's traditionally our beating dog for trying to get veteran stuff, and multiple times we reached out to Department of Human Services, and they've come and made presentations, but the health authority and the other entities seem to ignore us when we reach out to ask them. So I'm not sure, I mean, are there things in your gentleman's mind we could be doing better as a state as a whole?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, one of the areas that we're kind of experimenting in and working with is that it's a well-known fact that the VA lacks capacity in servicing veterans with mental health, that they're full. And one of the initiatives that we have going, and so does the National Guard, is that we're trying to we've had a small version of this that our Women Veterans Coordinator put on, but to train outside providers about military culture, best practices for PTSD treatment, and then giving them, having a list of those providers outside the VA that the federal VA could use through multiple programs that they have to basically, if the VA is full, they can refer, it's called a choice program, and refer those veterans out into the community to get treatment outside the VA. So these are areas we're kind of working into to get started. So that is one area that the state of Oregon could do to expand those a network of providers, especially in the rural areas. That is, if you live in Baker City, you're driving a long way for your VA appointment. If there would be a provider that understood and knew about PTSD best practices and could affiliate themselves with the VA and agree to work for VA as a contractor through the choice program, is that we feel that could help establish some care outside the VA.
Well, I love that concept, and I've been a supporter, and I've even had veterans say, I can't always go to the VA. I would like to have one in my community, but TRICARE won't pay for it, or the military won't pay for it. And so that's a federal issue. That's not our issue. Is that correct?
There are, Vice Chair, there are ways that the VA can pay for that. It has to be pre-approved and mm-hmm. agreed upon. And so that's kind of the area we're okay. making small steps into to make sure that we can, veterans throughout the state can receive treatment. It's kind of a homegrown solution.
I love that idea.
Okay. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, it's important that we find a way to coordinate and really reach out to these individuals. Everything that our veterans do for us, it's important that agencies figure out how to coordinate on their benefits. One of the areas that DHS and ODVA connect on are our benefits oftentimes can be confusing for individuals accessing them and can seem duplicative. I can get TRICARE medical, and I can be approved for Oregon Health Plan medical. I may have Medicare as well. Who's really authorizing at what point, and how do we work across those organizations? You include coordinated care organizations on top of that, and our staff that work across Oregon helping individuals apply and look for medical are often looking for assistance. And what Mitch shared here is really important. It's reaching out in the local communities is where we see our success. Having connections with the county veteran service officers and our local offices really help coordinate on individuals. When they have issues trying to access mental health, we can oftentimes look at the benefits and try to find ways for them to access benefits. As well as we look on the aging people disability side around long-term care benefits, we've been able to develop new models of care that incorporate different services to help individuals be able to access their services better in rural communities. So I think there's opportunities to look there. Again, I think as agencies continue to work across with each other, you get to see the benefits of what can be provided. Working with ODVA has been very beneficial for myself, and I believe is helping Oregonians, and I hope that the other departments will continue to see those opportunities.
Thank you.
Senator.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, would you mind if I asked a question?
Yeah.
I just may have missed it. You may have mentioned already, Mr. Singer, the House Bill 2422 from 2013 with the integrated application. Is there an estimated date when that comes online?
So DHS has the version available for our food stamps program on the online application. The other one, the current date for integrated eligibility to become rolled out is through December 31st, 2018. At that point, we'd have an application that would have it online and available there.
Thank
we
you.
Do collect veterans' information on other applications, I should point out, but we don't have the way to store it and easily pull it without hand going through applications.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify?
This is very helpful.
Senator Riley, would you like to? It's your bill. Would you like to? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I want to float an idea by you, Senator Riley. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So for the record, Senator Chuck Riley, Senate District 15, Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy, and Verbort. So the biggest reason to float this bill, it was to get it out and see if we could find, you know, some way to help some way to figure out how we can help these veterans who really need it. I'm not wedded to the idea of a task force, but I would, you know, I wanted some vehicle to get in front of you and see what we could get done. And I'd love to hear your idea.
Here's my idea, and I'll float it, and then I'll ask the committee members to discuss this. Is that I'd like to have counsel here go back into your bill and figure out how to make it more economical and closer to the legislature. And then I'd like council to review, and I will review with the appropriate leadership offices. The problem we have when we, the legislators, and your committee chair, we say we're going to do a work group is, you know, we can invite everybody and their third cousin to come. And as you see, short of a subpoena, which is not beyond my scope, which will make the presiding officer on my right really nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Not within my scope of requiring some people on your list here to come explain themselves. But I'm thinking that as a backstop and thinking of raising this issue with the House chair and the director of ODVA, if you would care to participate in that process and see if there's something more substantive, giving the VA lottery, the veterans lottery, something more substantive rather than just say, let's go study it. I think there's things that we could take action on and study as we go.
I'd love to be part of that process.
And then we keep your bill in reserve for a couple of weeks while we have still plenty of committee time and see if we get the attention of a few other agencies that ought to be participating. And then if they don't participate, then even if we have to, you know, seek counsel from higher leadership to say, okay, no, we're out of time. This really needs to go someplace else to get action. And we do it that way rather than study it, because my fear is it'll be two more years and we don't have two more years.
Right.
And if you're amenable to that, I would have the good administrator loop you into the meeting with the chairman of the House committee and the director of ODVA and see if there's something more substantive.
I think that's an adequate solution. We'll see where that goes.
And then if that doesn't work, then we'll be in a position to, you know, give them an invitation they cannot refuse.
Okay.
Okay. Colleagues?
Brilliant.
Yeah, right. Just what I need. Another food fight. With that, colleagues, we're going to stay there, Senator Ivor, and close the close of public on SB 129. I'm going to temporarily open a public hearing on SB 130. Senator, you're the only one that signed up to testify, and I'm going to sort of put it into the same box as the meeting that you and I and the chair of the House Veterans Committee will have with the ODVA director, if you do not mind.
I don't mind at all. I think that's great. This was a bill that I did for a few of my constituents who approached me because they knew I was a veteran and they knew I was a senator, and those two things together made them think that maybe I could help.
Okay. And
I'm happy to do that.
Okay, I appreciate that. Colleagues, any other suggestions? We'll take it upon ourselves to accomplish it, Senator Courtney. With that, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 130 and open a public hearing on SB 364. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, get my documents out of order. Senate Bill 364 creates an income tax credit for shipping containers donated to public entities to store emergency supplies within 1,000 feet of public buildings, equal to 10% of the container's retail value. Takes effect the 91st day after signee died. This measure is has a subsequent referral to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, and I believe it's Senator Frederick's measure, and he may be testifying in another committee along with the other proponent of the measure.
Okay, what we can do is, could you send staff to check on that, if you would, please? If someone could do that, and then we'll temporarily close the public hearing on SB 364, and then we'll open a public hearing on SB 661.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 661. States that monies in the emergency communications account may only be used for prescribed statutory purposes except in case of fiscal emergency, which is defined as a deficit of at least 12% below the revenue estimate for the biennium. This measure has a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means and is sponsored by Senator Olson. PowerPoint.
You notice you're the only person there, so you may speak, Senator.
PowerPoint, second. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator representing Senate District 20, the heart of Clackamas County. If you dial 911, what you will hear is, 911, what is your emergency? Critical. Critical to anyone that needs assistance. Perhaps this was the first 911 call known to man. And I won't say anything, Mr. Senator Courtney.
What are you doing?
These folks were sending up smoke signals, and they were talking about the fact that there's bad people coming. We need help.
You don't know that it's a smoke signal.
And a little comedy, it's Blundering Bear, him say, call a fire department. A 911 call. Colleagues, we have ORS 403-100. It is the policy of the state of Oregon to encourage and support the development of public safety networks and an emergency communication system and the rapid deployment of broadband and other communication services in areas of the state in which services do not exist. We made this bond with the people of Oregon, and we said we will tax you to provide services so that you can live safely, and if you have an emergency, you can call and receive assistance. And we know what it's like. We've seen them. We've been there. Auto accidents. A bicycle rider hit by a car. People dial 911 to ask for assistance. Medical emergencies. Fires. Very critical that they're able to call and have fire department and personnel come out to help them. And major burns, and you can see we've got the police there and the fire department. And of course, once again, a medical emergency. These are the systems that we use to call. not many people use the landlines anymore because there's not that many landlines. And from the ages, from when we started to get cellular telephones, we had radio telephones down to your current cell phone that you have in your pocket. We also have the opportunity to use voice over internet so that you can dial 911. And with today's modern cell phones, we can even do things that you would not have believed we could do 5 or 10 years ago. We made a promise when we took this tax and did this tax. The emergency communication system must provide interconnectivity between public safety answering points and interconnectivity with providers of the same or similar emergency response services nationally. That we would have the capability within each primary public safety answering point to receive all emergency calls placed locally within each 911 service area, and that the automatic location identification accurately portraying the location from which each emergency call originated from. This is in our statutes. Back in 2009, as an article from the Associated Press states, many states raided 911 funds, and we're not the only one to do it. They've taken more than $200 million that was swept throughout the U.S. in the last 2 years, and that was in 2009. Do we break our promise when we sweep money from 911? The promise is the capability to receive all emergency calls. If we cannot pay for the newest of technologies because we have swept these funds, I believe we've broken our promise. We're in a communication revolution. You all know it. Some people don't even carry cell phones, Mr. Chair. The next generation technologies, the objective of NG911 is to keep up with the consumer digital revolution and allow people to use all the digital tools they have available now to request assistance from first responders. Video, for example, video from static pre-positioned cameras. The cameras mounted on stoplights in the city of Salem would be an example. Video attached to police cars and police officers. Map-based applications. Crowdsourced images and videos. You've seen them on TV. You've seen pictures of riots. You've seen pictures of car accidents, of shootings. Automatic notification on airbag deployment. Wouldn't that be interesting when if you crash and your airbag goes off, it automatically calls 911. They know exactly where you are so they can get to you, even if you cannot make the call yourself. We already have put the interest from this account into the general fund. We actually had a bill passed that took the interest from the money we received from 911 and put it into the general fund. And there's no question about it. Future legislatures can change this bill. But I say that we should be the leaders in showing the importance of preventing sweeps of this fund. Can we, as legislatures, prevent someone from reporting an emergency because of outdated equipment? And the money in the 911 fund, that's what it goes for, is to update our communications technology so that we can receive those important life-saving messages from anywhere, at any time, at any place. And preventing sweeps is truly a matter of life or death. And I owe my life to 911. Thank you. I'll take any questions. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I do have two emails. One says the Board of County Commissioners supports Senate Bill 661 to prevent sweeps, and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Mr. Sprouse, Mr. Tennyson, and Ms. Ingram. And one of you gentlemen pull a third chair up there, if you would, please. I see it can only count two. Is there a third?
Got it. asked me to go first, so I'm going to start this, and I'll defer to our guest, Chair Broquist and members of the committee. My name is Mark Spross, and I appear before you today representing Oregon Combined Chapters of APCO-NENA and Clackamas County Communications to present testimony in favor of Senate Bill 661. APCO-NENA and Clackamas County both greatly appreciate your time and consideration moving this bill forward. We understand the burdens placed on our elected officials to maximize every dollar and know that there are hundreds of critical programs at every level of government that are in need of funding. What we are encouraged to see in this bill is that it ensures the funds our citizens have paid for in the maintenance and operation of our 911 system in Oregon will be used as promised. Many citizens do not understand the complexity of the 911 system. They simply know they can call 911 and someone will be there to answer their call and get them help if they need it. Most do not understand the time and money it takes to train our telecommunicators. They are unaware of the costs associated with the equipment necessary to answer their call and to keep the maintenance and infrastructure for phone lines, including connections between the wireless and wireline phone company and the 911 centers. Our 911 centers have not been able to keep up with technology changes. Although there are many reasons for this, costs associated with moving from legacy-based equipment to current technology is very expensive. Oregon is moving in the right direction, and as evidenced by upgrades to our statewide 911 infrastructure network and a rollout of text to 911 in the greater Portland metropolitan area and parts of the northern coast. However, costs continue to grow to implement and maintain this equipment. The 911 emergency access tax in Oregon has not been adjusted since 1995, even though the cost to provide these services has risen dramatically. In order to update equipment and infrastructure, it is imperative to have money set aside for upgrades and maintenance. I understand how easy it might be to see a large amount of tax revenue and think that taking some funds to fill a deficit today might not be a big issue. However, it is important to remember that any diversion of the 911 tax has great impact on our 911 system and our ability to meet the needs and expectations of our citizens in time of crisis. The final important point for consideration in any diversion of the 911 tax will shift fiscal shortfalls from the state to the local communities who are charged with maintaining the first line of defense in our emergency response network. I respectfully urge your support for Senate Bill 661.
Thank you. Okay. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, is that, can you hear me? Okay. I'm Mark Tennyson from the Oregon Military Department's Office of Emergency Management, and I am the manager of the state 911 program. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Senate Bill 661. The Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management takes a neutral position on Senate Bill 661. I would like to now provide some background on how the tax works and what the 911s help support. The Emergency Communications 911 tax of 75 cents per month, or 75 cents per retail transaction, is imposed upon each consumer or paying retail customer subscriber with access to the 911 emergency reporting system. Prior to distribution of the Emergency Communications tax per statute, the Department of Revenue may receive up to 1% of the 911 receipts for administrative cost purposes, and the Office of Emergency Management receive up to 4%. After deductions for the administrative expenses, 35% is transferred into the 911 subaccount, with the remaining funds of approximately 60% being distributed to the cities and counties on a per capita basis quarterly. ORS 403.235 establishes the Emergency Communications account to receive the proceeds of the Emergency Communications tax. ORS 403.235 establishes the 911 subaccount to receive the 35% of the proceeds for each calendar year into the emergency communications account. The amounts placed in the 911 subaccount are to pay for all costs related to providing the backbone of the statewide enhanced 911 system. This emergency communications subaccount pays for all the equipment and components it takes to ring a call for help to the PSAP or 911 center. These costs include circuiting and network costs, which will allow location and phone number information to be received for each 911 call, geographic information system information to determine and plot locations of 911 callers, and the needed 911 call taking equipment, such as the consoles and servers, to receive 911 calls at the public safety answering point. The quarterly distribution of funds to cities and counties on a per capita basis on average statewide helps support approximately 28% of total PSAP budgets. Technology is ever-changing and expanding rapidly, and the emergency communications attacks will be relied upon to help support emerging technologies in the future. This concludes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. I've also been asked and authorized to speak on behalf of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. My board just took a vote on the bill, and they voted to support. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association are the elected officials who manage Oregon's Rural Fire Protection District. Like you, they are elected officials, and they absolutely understand the importance of a balanced budget, and they understand how tough that is. Whether it be our very smallest district who are holding auctions or bake sales to purchase turnout equipment, or even our largest districts, all of them believe that this is a priority for the fire service. We just had a conference in November, and when I gave them the legislative update and what we prognosticated for public safety bills, I was asked, do you see a bill coming forward, or can we bring a bill forward that would prevent the sweeps of the 911 fund? So we very much appreciate Senator Olson bringing the bill forward. With regard to the Volunteer Firefighters Association, they, as first responders, believe it's important to have as much technology as possible, and they think it's important for the 911 system to keep up with ever-changing technology. It would be so helpful to them to have all of the information that's available to be able to pinpoint exactly where they're going and exactly what the situation is. And if I could just give a personal experience that I had a couple of years ago. I live out in Buena Vista, which is an unincorporated area in Polk County. It is it's right between north of Albany, south of Independence. And I was coming home late one night, and it had been raining very hard. And I turned down Buena Vista Road, and I saw that it was completely flooded. And I almost, drove through the water because it was dark. And I called 911 to suggest that, to advise them of the situation and maybe have someone come out and put up some road signs or something. And I got 911 in Marion County. And they said, well, I tried to explain to them where I was. And they said, well, you've reached Marion County. You must be in Marion County. And I said, oh, no, I'm in Polk County. I'm on Buena Vista Road. And they said, well, Buena Vista Road is in Marion County. And we went back and forth on exactly where I was calling from. And had I been injured, had I been in an auto accident and called, they would not have been able to pinpoint where I was. And I found that very distressing. I love living out in the country, but I'm going to feel a lot better about it when the technology catches up. And several years ago, when the funds were swept, I'm haunted by the story that was provided during testimony about the gentleman who was down in Eugene and was coming out of a restaurant or a bar or some such thing late at night, and was stabbed and called 911, and because he was disoriented, couldn't adequately describe where he was, and he was on the phone with 911 when he bled out. And I just think this is a matter of life and death, and it's also a matter of public trust. And the legislature is talking a lot right now about transparency, and we just think this is a really good place to start, is with the protection and the safety of your constituents. And again, we want to thank Senator Olson, and on behalf of the fire district directors and the volunteer firefighters, we urge you to support this bill.
Thank you. Questions, Madam Vice Chair, Senator Olson, Senator Gordon?
Nope.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on SB 661 in the audience? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 661, and we're going to reopen a public hearing on SB 364.
Senator Frederick is in the hallway. Coming
up. Okay. And Ms. Graves, you want to come up and pinch hit for the senator while he's counsel? If you'd explain the bill, and then you can pinch it. And don't, there's Senator Frederick right there. You're saved by the arriving. Say, please sit down, because you're on the list to testify too.
You can never tell anybody. for sure. Well, this yes.
So right. I'm going
the question you asked me 2 years
ago.
Unfortunately, Senator Frederick, the good senator to my right is being summoned to echelons above us.
So once again,
he will not be able to listen to your riveting testimony. I apologize for that.
I try to emulate him, and he doesn't even listen to me.
You were here earlier, and you didn't speak to me. I felt hurt.
Now you see what I have to put up with the committee chair, right? With him on.
I was going to say I can't win no matter what.
Yeah, right. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, Senate District 22 from North and Northeast Portland. Today, it's commonplace in Oregon to speak of emergency preparedness and plans for disaster relief as we think about the aftermath of what many of us will refer to as the big one. We can all remember the buzz that was created after the Catherine Schultz of the New Yorker published The Great Big One. She made special mention of how underprepared Oregon schools were for such a disaster at the end of the article. We are tragically underprepared for more localized emergencies, let alone the effects of a shifting subduction zone. Frankly, everybody talks about emergency preparedness, but we have been slow to act. Some of the most vulnerable Oregonians are our students, whether it's a fumes leak at Harriet Tubman Elementary or Middle School, which I managed to witness, or a facade collapse at the Malala Union High School during the spring break quake, if you remember. These events portray the inadequacy of external resources that could be used to keep children safe and to save lives. Much of emergency preparedness for schools is centered on safely removing students from buildings. However, there are a few examples of schools that provide emergency caches outside the building, except for the model that we find in Lincoln County, where they house emergency supplies in shipping containers. Senate Bill 364 aims to increase the availability of these shipping containers to public schools at no cost to the schools. I propose a tax credit that is 10% of the retail value of the shipping containers. This shipping container credit will serve as an incentive for owners to donate the containers to be used as emergency caches outside of the schools throughout the state. This bill does not mandate that schools accept shipping containers to be used as emergency caches. It does not detail what should be kept in the caches, nor how they should be maintained. Lincoln County School District's model serves as a good example of how the containers can be put to use. There are about 1,300 public schools in Oregon, and a tax credit that is 10% of the retail value of the containers will have a minimal fiscal impact on the state. What we have to consider is the value of the need to prepare for an emergency compared to the relatively small cost. Senate Bill 364 represents one small step in the right direction to protect some of our most vulnerable Oregon students. I urge you to take a look at that, and I hope you'll support me in this.
Please proceed, Madam.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, my name is Sue Graves. I'm the safety coordinator for Lincoln County School District on the beautiful Oregon coast. And as the senator has said, we have created some disaster caches throughout our school district. And so I have a PowerPoint presentation that I would like to show you to tell you about those. So for many years, we've been doing earthquake drills, drop, cover, and hold, and evacuate the building. But as we've learned more about the risks with the Cascadia subduction zone, we have also done some additional planning for what do we do after we get outside the building. So I'm going to briefly review some of the implications of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake to tell you our thinking in creating these disaster caches, and then you'll see some pictures of what they look like. So when we have this magnitude 8 or 9 or greater earthquake, we will have damages to home and businesses. There will be landslides and road damage. Bridges will collapse. This is not just a coastal event. This will affect the I-5 corridor also. Our water supply will be severely damaged and gas lines will be ruptured. Here's a picture of a water truck delivering water to these refugees in Myanmar. Is this realistic for us with the road and bridge damage? No. There will also be damage to schools, and there will be aftershocks, many aftershocks, making our buildings very difficult to reoccupy, even those that have had seismic rehabilitation, because the ground in these big Cascadia subduction zone earthquakes, the ground just keeps shaking and keeps shaking. As a matter of fact, after the big Japan earthquake, in the first 2 days after that, they had 154 aftershocks of magnitude 5 or greater, and they continued on. But I mean, that's how much the buildings continue to get hammered and hammered. So sheltering inside the building is not realistic. We also will have the risk of hypothermia because we'll be sheltering outside. This is a picture of the Japanese, some Japanese people sheltering outside, and it snowed actually when they had their big earthquake. So like I said, we do earthquake drills in Oregon. It's a requirement in all of our schools to do 2 drills per year, drop, cover, and hold on. I know in our schools we're really good at that. But what about after the earthquake? So we evacuate. We account for all of our students, and we supervise students. So that's a good step. Then we are prepared to meet their immediate needs. Some students may be injured. We'll treat their medical injuries. Professional responders won't be able to get to us for a while, so we're going to have to be equipped to do this on our own. If students are trapped, we're going to have to be equipped to search and rescue, to rescue them. And in our high schools, we have a teen cert program where the teens are taught light search and rescue skills, all kinds of disaster response skills safely in a class that they take. They're going to have to be sheltered from the weather, and they're going to need to use restrooms even though they're outside. We set up family reunification sites so that those parents that can get there, that don't have to rely on the roads, you know, that are nearby, are able to come and reunite with their children. For those that don't, we're going to move them to an outdoor shelter location that, based on what the circumstances look like, where we can set up our tents that are in our disaster caches. So we have to activate our disaster caches, where we will have shelter and warmth, basic needs, water and food, sanitation, and supervision of children and care for them until their families can get there, which may take days, depending on the situation. So here's what our disaster caches look like. Oh, before I go on, that picture of the tent being set up, those are our teen cert students setting those tents up. So our priorities when we started developing these disaster caches for our schools, they have to be low maintenance. School people don't have time to take care of stuff like this. They're all about educating. So if we get these, they have to be very low maintenance. We have to locate them away from our structures that could collapse, and have just basic survival supplies, things that are non-perishable or very long shelf life, because we won't have the money to replace things. We won't have the time to go in and check on them, that kind of thing. And it has to be sustainable, easy to take care of, hopefully a gift for a future generation, but it may not be. We may have to use it in ours. So those are kind of our priorities. So we decided to get steel shipping containers. They're wind and water tight. They're not very expensive. Rodents can't get in. You don't get mold or anything. They're just like, this was the best solution. We looked at a lot of different solutions. This is the solution we chose. And those are some of our caches there. They have solid floors. They're just a great place to store things. They have really good adequate locks. The little red circle there shows a little hidden lock that you can put up in there so people can't easily use a wire cutter or a bolt, you know, to cut through. So there's different ways to secure them. And then we have just practical things, rain ponchos, hats, Mylar blankets, these tents, these heavy-duty tents. Now, they're not like great camping tents, but when you have thousands of students to shelter, you have to think economically, what can I do to shelter thousands of people? So we get these big tents that can easily house 30 people, a classroom full of students, and they're very inexpensive. And then we get these big 55-gallon barrels that we fill with water, and they have a purifier solution in that makes the water last for 5 years. So every 5 years, they have to be rotated out, which is a reasonable amount of time, you know, for us to go in there and do some, you know, re-inventory everything, you know, check everything, change out the water with new purifier. We also get water filter straws. That's that picture in the upper right-hand corner. And then those are super cool things. They're like the size of a pin, a little bit fatter than that. And as parents come and pick up their students. We want to send them all home with the water filter straw. So as they collect water from rainwater, from creeks that haven't been contaminated by tsunamis or mudslides, they can actually just drink through them and it filters the water. So they have a sustainable method to survive, because water, you have to have water to survive. We might have to use those depending on how long we have the students at school too. And then medical and sanitation supplies. Those buckets with the toilet seat lids, we have in every classroom in all of our schools. Not just for this hazard, but for if we have to lock down for an extended period or other things. All of these supplies could be used for many different kinds of hazards that we could experience. And then we also have search and rescue supplies. Because again, we're going to be on our own probably without first responder help for quite a while. And then this is just a picture of a truck delivering them. You can get 2 20-foot shipping containers on one truck, so it saves the delivery fee. So those are just a few things. There's a lot of lessons learned that I tell other communities about as they ask us about them, because we've been doing this for a few years. But we feel like every year we're adding more and more to them, and we're becoming more and more prepared to be able to care for the students in our charge if this event occurs when school is in session. This is an example of what you can do with $15,000. You can get a cache outfitted for 600 people with basic supplies. And just for an example, and that's one of our caches there at one of our schools. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Yes?
I'm going to ask her questions first.
Oh, ask her. That's
fine. Then I'll come back to you.
No, she's the expert. Go right ahead.
How many of these schools do you have equipped with caches?
We have them by area, so schools that can, in walking distance from each other.
Right.
And so we have 5 different areas where one school is isolated, so they have their own. 2 schools share a cache. 3 schools share a cache, that kind of thing. And that way, students all in that area can walk to one general area where we'll set up kind of a tent city, and then parents, as they're able to come from that community, will come to one place to get their kids. Siblings will be reunited already, that kind of thing.
Any idea of, I mean, I think you're on the forefront here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So are you aware of any other school districts of the 201 that are left over beside you that are doing this?
I don't know that, but I know that many of our communities in Lincoln County are doing this in their neighborhoods also. And it's interesting because our county commissioners in Lincoln County have really prioritized disaster preparedness. So they offer, this is help. Here's the key. It's so hard for people to start. They need a starting place. Our county commissioners offer a $2,500 matching grant to cities, fire districts, now to schools, because I asked them, can schools be included? It used to be just cities and fire districts for disaster preparedness initiatives, you know, supplies, that kind of thing. So 1 year I went to them and I said, you're offering your fire districts and cities this $2,500 matching grant. What about schools? We have to take care of kids, you know? So they let the schools in on that. So then I was able to say, okay, so the school district, if we put in $2,500, the county commissioners will also, that's $5,000. Then I went to the city and I went to the fire district and said, what if we all apply for a joint grant and with all of our matching monies and the county commissioners, that's $15,000, and then we can get a cash for the school. It's a starting place. And if school's in session and an earthquake or disaster occurs, the school gets the first choice to use those supplies for the kids. It's a very vulnerable population. If school's not in session when a disaster occurs, the city and the fire district can take possession of that cash to use for community. And so having that starter funds from the county commissioners to kind of help us get going has really been great. We'd like to have a lot more than we do have, but every year we do a little bit more. We apply for another one of those grants. We all pitch in our money and we expand.
Just 1 second. Senator, your priority.
Pardon?
When we send this, you notice my verbal, when we send this to revenue, right? Because that's why I sit there too. What's your priority here in terms of, I'm looking down here, we have schools, we have community colleges, universities, branches of government, state agencies, and governmental subdivisions. Prioritize those.
For this system?
Right.
Schools.
Schools first.
K-12, absolutely. You have a school in every neighborhood, sure. And you may have several schools in one, you know, in walking distance. For a lot of districts have that, so that's good. But schools are a central part, and for this particular situation, this is a first step, because in many cases you have districts that have emergency preparedness. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. The Portland School District, where I was for a while, had an emergency preparedness effort, and they do now. They've started to beef it up, but it was pretty minimal when I was there. And this would have, if we had had a true large emergency, we would have had a lot of problems. We had a lot of little emergencies, and we had some to struggle to get a system so that kids knew where to go. We had safe spaces, all of those kinds of things. But with this is an I would like to have this take place in terms of schools. Absolutely.
Okay. Madam Vice Chair.
Well, it says the tax credit goes to whoever donates the cash.
Yeah, that goes to not the cash. The tax credit that I'm talking about is just for the container.
Okay. I thought.
No, it's just for the container.
CHE cash no, is well, the same as container.
Yeah, no, mine is just talking about the container right now,
yeah,
because I'm not sure what people want to put in it. They have a really good list. It's I'm calling the container the cash, not the,
okay, the container,
the cash site, okay, I should say.
So people would buy these and then donate them? I don't have one of those around. I'm just wondering.
Well, we have.
Who would donate?
The container companies, the shipping companies.
Oh, so they get the tax credit.
That's right.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. This is really a unique idea, and it's really kind of cool. But the first question I have is, I noticed you had the red circle around the locks.
Yeah.
Who holds the keys? Because if there's an emergency and the keys get lost, you're in trouble.
Right, it's true. So in the schools, we have some keys. Certain people have keys. And then our local fire departments have the keys.
Okay.
It kind of depends on some of the partnerships that we have developed. We have MOUs written that talk about them, and, you know, different people are given the keys so that you can get to them.
Well, you know, they have what they call a Knox lock, which,
yeah,
is a fire lock,
mm-hmm,
and firemen can, everybody's,
yes,
got that key.
So far, our fire departments have decided not to do that on these caches. The Knox box system that we have in Lincoln County for our fire districts, the schools wouldn't be able to access those. It's kind of the weird way it's set up. Only the fire,
okay,
departments can. So it's, I think each community would figure out what works for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then secondly, and this is the biggest part, you know, you mentioned the Fukushima earthquake, and what did the most damage? The tidal wave.
Right.
And what probably will happen with these, since they're not secured to the ground, is they'll be out to sea someplace.
Well, these wouldn't
so,
be...
So have you put them at a level... I know they would try to keep them near the schools, but are they out of the flood zone where the wave would come in?
Yes. All of our schools in Lincoln County are not in the tsunami zone, and all of these containers,
excellent,
are not in the tsunami zone. Absolutely. So that's a very good point.
Yeah, that's excellent, because I was afraid that they'd be out to, and Senator Frederick would be out there trying to paddle them back into shore. this is, Mr. Chair, this is really unique, and this is really a great idea, because these things are really, really good. Everybody uses them anyhow. And to be able to have an emergency supply for something we anticipate is going to happen is absolutely amazing, and I wholeheartedly support this.
Thank you.
I do have one follow-up question for Sue. The packing list that you had that you're putting in your container, how did you develop that?
We started with, okay, what's most important for survival? All the survivalists say shelter and water are your two most important things. So we realized we have to have tents, because once we evacuate the building, rain is an issue. We got, you know, rain ponchos immediately we can put on. And then while people set up the tents, that gives us some protection. We can get under that cover to get out of the rain. Mm-hmm. And then we have to have water to survive. So those were our first two priorities. And then some of the other things just started, okay, well, there's going to be some injuries. So we're going to need some medical supplies. And we also don't want to have stuff that's going to expire real soon, because we know that's not sustainable for us. So these caches for now and probably for the near future are just going to be very basic survival supplies, because we want them to be sustainable. And it's taking us a while, mm-hmm, to develop and expand them and get enough for each of the areas.
In foodstuffs?
Yeah, we hope that we're going to be able to salvage food from our schools. We have search and rescue gear so that we can get in there safely if the schools aren't damaged too bad. And the way our foods work in our school kitchens is Actually, most of those foods are pre-cooked, even though they're frozen, so they're still edible. Mm-hmm. That will only last us so long. We've really had a hard time thinking about food supplies in these containers. Some have been donated. One time, the Red Cross donated a whole bunch of MREs, meals ready to eat, and that's in one of the caches. And in one of our cities, they're all a little bit different because different partnerships and different people donate. Once you have a container there, you'll be fascinated by how many people and agencies will just donate stuff to them, which is wonderful. I mean, we've experienced that in a lot of different ways. But in one of our cities, actually bought a whole bunch of survival food bars that have a really long shelf life. As a school district, we haven't gone there yet because we're still working on some of those basic shelter, water, and medical things that we really feel like is a priority. We're going to be hungry once the food runs out, but we have to have shelter and water, you know, and some of those medical supplies. So maybe we'll get there little by little. Yeah.
Other questions, Kramer? Senator?
I just want to say that there are several things that you have also done, and it's important to point that out. To have the high school students trained, because you're not going to have access to communication. I mean, even if you have radios and things there, but the ability for a high school student to run over to another place and come back and act as a Wells Fargo person, if you will. That's something we need to be able to have as well. And so congratulations on that and be able to know first aid. It helps them anywhere they go.
Mr. Chair.
That's what that would help as well.
I'd also add that a couple of years back, because of an emergency task force that we had, we were able to incorporate heavy lift capabilities from our heavy lift helicopters that we have stationed in our state. We have five different heavy lift helicopters. And by employing your product, the cache or the container, we could actually fill containers with material over here, food, water, and supplies, and fly them over because they can handle 20 tons. And they could be flown over and dropped down for you to use at your convenience.
Exactly.
And actually maybe even turn it into a housing kind of thing to put people in to get them out of the weather also.
Amazing.
So that's available if you obviously didn't know about it, but that's available if we need it.
Yeah.
And God forbid that we need it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on SB 364? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 364. Colleagues, just a refresher, there's no meeting on Thursday.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And then next Tuesday, we'll carry SB 364, which we just heard, for a work session next week. And then we'll start working on the other bills that we have, including 143. And, Council, if you would be so kind as to look at the ability to financially reduce the financial impact of the task force in terms of what it might cost. And maybe Madam Vice Chair and I will talk about it. I mean, I think it could be done as a work group, but my fear, unfortunately, is that many times when we ask agencies to come participate, unless they're directed to do so, they never show up. And in this particular case, we actually need one of these agencies to show up to make it worthwhile. So more to be on that. Anything for the good of the order? If not, hearing it to be on that. Anything for the good of the order? If not,